Yo, welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. I am your host, Neil Horowitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJH287, LinkedIn as well, the website, dsmsports.net. But I don't want to waste any more time. Let's get right into it. Got a tremendous show for you guys today. I was so psyched to be able to talk to this guy. We had a great, great interview. My guest on the podcast today is Akshay Ram. He is a product manager at Adobe and is truly all over the SM Sports space. As you'll hear, though, the product management he does transcends sports for sure. He has a lot of connections in the sports space and has experience there as well. You'll hear about his time with Syracuse as well as working with Bleacher Report. Tons of lessons to share, tons of insight into how we think about the creative space within sports in particular and beyond. Thinking about ROI of creative, how do we think about balancing creative needs and demands and the unending demand for more and more content, where generative AI will come into play and how it already has within the Adobe suite and beyond. Just so much good stuff here. So here he is, Akshay Ram of Adobe.
I am back with today's guest, and I am so psyched to be speaking with him. We just had a great chat offline. It seems like a great dude, really smart. If you follow the sports and social space, you have definitely heard of this guy. My guest on the podcast today is Akshay Ram. He is product manager at Adobe. Welcome to the podcast today, Akshay.
Thank you so much, Neil. So great to join you.
Hell yeah. So psyched to pick your brain. You really get the space. You are a rock star in the space, and I feel bad because you're so much younger than me, too. But that just means the industry is in good shape with folks like you leading the way, the next generation. Before we get into our discussion today, Akshay, tell us about your career path. Tell us about the stops you had along the way and obviously what you're doing today. And any tips for folks that kind of want to do what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I always love telling this story because it goes all the way back to when I was 12 years old. And it started with this fever dream, just like every 12-year-old today, which was just to become a YouTuber. And that's what really invigorated all this. I used to watch Chris Move on YouTube, and I'm like, hey, why can't I be the next Chris Move? And it all started with me trying to convince my parents to get the equipment to start recording myself and film YouTube videos. And for me, I was like, as a 12-year-old, like, what if I can make so much money as a YouTuber? And it took some convincing with my parents to get them on board with all of this. But, you know, I could go on and on about that whole part. Essentially, I never ended up recording a single YouTube video because part of the process, I fell in love with creating my own brand and trying to shape the YouTube channel over just creating the content for it. And so that's when I started to discover some of the creative tools. And it also aligned with a lot of the things that my friends were doing on social media because we were all just getting on the Instagrams and Twitters of the world. And so we all wanted to find ways to share content with each other. And being sports fans, we wanted to find a way to translate our creative aspirations to what we were posting on social media. And so we would just post wallpapers for fun and just go back and forth. And slowly going through social media, I started to build a community of designers that we could communicate with on apps like Kick, if you remember Kick. You know, we would build all these different channels of conversations, and solely through time, I was just posting stuff that I loved for fun and building relationships with different people on social media. And part of that process, you know, eventually as I started to really understand what the sports space looked like and what creative content looked like, I take it back to the story of high school where my guidance counselor was like, hey, I see you're doing all these things. Why don't you go reach out to a local college and see if you can get some experience there? And so Holy Cross was a neighboring college to me back in Massachusetts, and I wanted to reach out to them to see if I can work in athletics. And so funny enough, you know, the story gets crazier where the same day I was about to reach out to them, the head designer there had posted on Twitter about looking for interns for the next summer.
Wow.
And so it lined up perfectly. Then I was able to reach out, and I don't think they were probably expecting a high schooler to reach out to them. And so that was kind of my start where I wanted to go work in athletics there. And through that process, I did have an idea that I wanted to go to Syracuse University. And I knew that they were known for their communications program, graphic design. And so I initially intended on going for that. And then, long story short, they started opening up more programs for sports, and the opportunity to work in sports was something that really attracted me outside of just graphic design. And so they had a sports analytics program, and I loved math. I loved analytics. I'm sure we both shared that that common relationship of understanding the metrics that go into what we see and do all the time. And so I wanted to be part of that program. Didn't get into that either. So I didn't get in for graphic design or the sport analytics program. So I ended up just taking a degree in engineering and computer science. So that was the school I was part of, and I did information science. And the really cool part about Syracuse and that program was that I was able to shape my curriculum the way I wanted to. So I was able to still minor in sport analytics and translate a lot of those classes to my program. And so it was really cool that I was able to just basically do that major without having to be in that. And it also gave me the freedom to then explore what working in Syracuse's athletics program looked like for their football team. And my schedule, you know, I love hacking my schedule. And so I was also able to work at Bleacher Report while working at Syracuse at the same time. Wow. So I was basically going to class in the morning, working at Syracuse after class. And then at nighttime, I'd work night shifts for Bleacher Report for their social pages. And so I would say my college career was super fun in that sense, where I was able to really formulate it the way that I want to, but also get an opportunity to learn the skills that go outside of just creating content, understanding strategy. And, you know, a lot of those things translated to what my job is now as a product manager at Adobe. And so I think, you know, for me, everything feels full circle being at Adobe now, someone that learned the tools and tried understanding how it translates into a creative career back when I was 12, to then be able to 10 years later have an influence on what the future roadmap looks like, what product strategy development looks like. That's essentially my role now. But so I'm truly grateful that that whole journey led me to, you know, starting from the gate and helping the company build the future of the tools.
Hell yeah. I mean, I just love that story so much, man. Like, because I talk to students and young professionals all the time, and it's about like understanding what skills you want to develop and looking for those opportunities that are next door, like going to that college, like going to Holy Cross and just checking them out. And you did it all. Like you said, I need to develop these skills. I want to get some experience, and you went and did it. So as you're starting to develop these skill sets, creative analytics and just getting your foot in the door in sports, like, did you have an idea of like, I'm working toward this role? I mean, obviously you're in Adobe now, but like when you were back in high school, college early on, that I'm developing all these skills and experiences because I'm going to be a creative director of a sports team, or I'm going to be a head of strategy someday. Like what was kind of like the vision that was guiding the skill development experience along the way?
Yeah, you might call me crazy for saying this, but I actually wanted to be a GM of an NBA team. You know, as crazy as it sounds, before, like the reason why I fell in love with the sport analytics program was because I thought that was going to get me one step closer. I always thought being in graphic design was going to get me into the doors of a sports team. But after I got into the doors of a sports team, my goal was to bring my interest of analytics and understanding the game in a different dimension, right? To then translate that into a front office role. And so the goal was always to work for a front office, to work in sports and do that, because I never saw anyone that looked like myself that came from my background work in that capacity, especially for the NBA. And now it's like, so I feel so grateful to know that the Indian community, Asian community is now a bigger part of those type of roles. And there are people there that can influence that. But, you know, at that time, I felt like I wanted to be at the forefront of that. And so that was the goal, to always be a GM of a sports team. But everything up till then, I knew that it was smaller skills that would slowly build up to being able to actually be that GM role. I think for some time, I definitely thought that I could be a creative director or be able to manage a creative team. But at the end of the day, for me, it was always trying to be a leader for something, whether that was a team, a product, or a culmination of what that all looks like. And so that was always a vision. I think the role specifically was GM.
And inadvertently or not, you kind of developed the skills that really serve you in your role today of understanding analytics and strategy, and certainly the creative side as well. And so it's cool to see that, like, maybe you didn't have the GM role, or at least not yet, but you ended up in a place that really is leveraging all those skills. Tell me.
Yeah, 100%. Go ahead. Yeah, I think, you know, it's when I tell people, I say that my role is essentially the GM of a product, right? Like, that's a lot of what my role is now, is like thinking about it through the same lens of like, how do we bring people together? How do we bring our ideas together to shape a future of a system? And so I feel like I'm still living that in some capacity, but just not in sports.
Yeah. What did content production look like at Syracuse? And we're going to talk a lot about content today, of course, with you being with Adobe, and mm-hmm. I definitely want to dive into sort of like this more democratization of content to some degree. The fact that like me being a relative noob in Adobe can create better content than I could have 10 years ago without having those more specialized set of skills. But I want to talk briefly just about what the content structure looked like at Syracuse. We've had people on this podcast in the past from college athletics, big and small, and some structures are different than others. So what did it look like there, and what kind of role did you play during your time there?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it all always differs between different college teams, like you said, right? And a big part of my attraction to Syracuse at that time was they had people that really cared about the details that go into creating content, the people that understood that like the small flashy typography that goes in video actually matters. And, you know, we need to essentially create content and transition that to delivering an experience, whether that's in studio or on social or digital. And so that's kind of what the overarching message was. And so when I was looking at Syracuse, that team was fairly small. I think they had a grad student at that time mainly running it from the athletic side and doing all kinds of work. And the SIDs would help support by creating some of the smaller templates that would go onto social or digital, right? The intention was, so we sell tickets. I'm sure that's going to come up multiple times. We talk through what does the role of all the creative functions come together. But I think that was always the main message. Like, how do we use content as a leverage to build an audience to sell tickets? And at that time, the fact that creative wasn't prioritized as much was something I was super attracted to. At the same time, my background was also in recruiting, whether that was football recruiting or basketball recruiting. I had so many different ties in that capacity. And so I think a lot of my work was translated to the football side, where I could influence what it means to get the right players to shape a team. And then the other side of that, when I worked in athletics, was, okay, now that we have the players on the team, how do we make sure we shine a good light on them so that we can actually translate that to fan engagement and selling tickets? And so that's how I always viewed it, that those were the different channels and how we were creating content. And in order to support that, you know, the one thing I take pride in going to Syracuse is a lot of it was intern driven. And so there were a lot of students that really cared about sports, that cared about creating content, that helped shape a lot of what we did. And we had people that really understood the creative side that empowered us to do that. And there wasn't a specific strategy that we followed all the time. I think we knew what the restrictions were that coaches set, that different members of athletics set. But we also knew that our goal was to shine light on the athletes and find ways to connect their stories with our fans so that the fans would essentially show up to the stadium. And so I think that's how we essentially supported it all.
And especially, I'm interested to know, because especially a school like Syracuse, where it is Power 5, has a good history, I mean, Donald McNabb era and all that, and of course, decorated men's basketball history with Jim Boeheim going back several decades until he finally retired and hung it up. Like, when you guys look at who you want to kind of emulate, or you look around the rest of the college athletics ecosystem, you look at like, oh, look at what Clemson's doing, look at what LSU is doing, or look at what this school is doing. They may have different resources, different goals, different size and scale of programs. Like, did you guys focus on, we need to be the best that we can be, we need to be good compared to other schools in our conference, or did you guys get pressure to like, hey, look at what Clemson's doing, why can't we do what they're doing, when they have maybe, you know, six, seven times the number of students that you guys do working on content? Like, what kind of set the stage for this? Is, we're going to maximize what we're able to do, and here's what we're shooting for.
Yeah, I think I'm going to probably use this a lot throughout our conversation, right? It depends. And in this case, it really depends on who you are going to. And part of the challenge of working in college athletics is, while we do have one vision of going in selling tickets, people do have different agendas on how to get there. And so maybe that is focusing on yourself. And I feel like a lot of people did prioritize, let's focus on the Syracuse brand and the Syracuse community and the Syracuse culture, while other people that probably are overseeing this at a higher level, they're comparing it to the rest of the ACC. How are those schools supporting their teams? And they might not have the answer right away. The coaches might not be asking that directly. But that's where it all comes into play on, you know, how are we delivering for what we need to get done? And so I think the priority was definitely ourselves on making sure we're the best version of Cuse that shows up all the time. And I think it always, you know, sports changes, the landscape of sports changes all the time. And so you do kind of need to have an eye on what the rest of the conference or the whole NCAA is going in. And so I think maybe there wasn't as much of a focus when I was there about the rest of the conference and the rest of the NCAA. But I think especially in today's world, that is something you need to prioritize. You need to know that you're moving in the same direction. And while you do focus on yourself, know that you're supporting it at the same capacity other schools are.
And how do you ultimately like meld those objectives as well? Because I think, you know, you talk to most people in college athletics and they're like, it's recruiting, and then maybe some ticket sales and donations after that. Depending on who you're talking to. You're talking to the coaches, it's recruiting. Talking to external relations, it might be this. Talking to, obviously, ticket sales, marketing, it might be this. Fan experience comes into play as well. So, like, do you ultimately have to sort of balance? I mean, is there, like, you want to find content that can sort of accomplish all goals, but now you have, like, I mean, especially now with NIL and the transfer portal, you're almost having to keep athletes as happy as possible so they want to stay with you. You want to have recruits coming, you know, being excited to come there as well. So, like, are those objectives always going to be top of mind of, like, we need to have, like, this much content that's really focused on student athletes and maybe even some stuff that's going to end up in the DMs of recruits that may not even see the light of day, whereas other stuff needs to be focused on, you know, the general ticket sales, fan experience, and stuff like that. Like, how does that balance look, and how's it evolved as the college athletic space has evolved?
Yeah, I can start off by talking about how we prioritize it, especially working for the football side. And I'm really grateful that, you know, the people under Coach Baber's staff at Syracuse really trusted me in kind of shaping that and brought the right people in to understand what that looks like. And so I think at that time, while recruiting has an overarching, you know, view of what it takes to actually bring a guy in, the content essentially should reach those folks first, right? Because they need to have a good understanding of what the program looks like in order for them to commit and actually show, you know, their commitment to the school, but also what they're going to do on the field once they get there. And so I think we definitely looked at everything from the recruiting lens first, which was, you know, do we have all the information on our social channels that is going to give him or her, you know, the right insights before they maybe make a trip for a visit? How do we get that there? Is there certain angles that we want to play that's aligned with pop culture? A lot of things that we did, especially signing day and some of the batch graphics that we created, were all aligned around bigger moments, you know, album releases, all those kind of stuff. So we had the freedom to work around that. And I think Syracuse and the folks that we had there, we really pushed that as much as we could. And we were able to present our brand with some of these pop culture brands in the best light. And so that was something that we took pride in, for sure. But like I said, it depends on how it translates to other departments too, right? And so when you're looking at ticket sales and fan engagement, it's really hard when you only have one or two graphic designers to support all those. And so then comes down to who's making the call for priorities. And in the college space, I don't think that specific person is established as much. And so it makes it a little more challenging. And I think that's part of what that transition looks like. So that's what I experienced. And of course, after I left college athletics, NIL was more prominent. And so the recruiting stuff has just taken another level in regards to what is expected, not required, expected of creative teams to put on social media. And so, you know, that's the first thing that a recruit's going to go to, right? They get the offer from the coach. They're going to look up a team's social channels to see what they're posting about. If they don't have enough information, if coaches are gatekeeping information and preventing creatives from actually producing content that's relevant for a recruit to make a decision or not, like, that tool's going to fall behind. Let's just be honest here, right? And so that's where creatives' role in producing content with the access and the transparency is valuable in today's age, where it might have been kind of looked back on. You know, when I look back on what I went through, maybe that wasn't prioritized as much, but that has to be at the forefront of what schools are looking at now.
Yeah. I mean, there's like no such thing as too much content, it seems like, a lot of times. And that's why
100%.
A big topic now. And let me jump from, I'm sure, your own experiences talking to a bunch of creatives. I know something that seems like it's coming up more and more now is the sort of intangible value of having strong creative, whether that is a recruit saying, look at the sick content this team produces. Like, I want to go there and be like, whatever, become a comic book superhero as part of their content. And they look at their NSD content. It's really dope. Or also in like the team space or even the college space as well. A potential corporate partner or sponsor might be looking at your content and look like, this guy's really do a great job with content. Look at, like, if we work with them, we're going to get a great sponsor activation because they really take their creative seriously. Or even attracting the next creatives that are on your team. That I've talked to people that run creative outlets with teams who are like, the better content we put out there, the better creatives that want to work for us, because they see the flexibility, they see the opportunity they have to really stretch their muscles and flex their muscles. And so there's all these like intangible values that aren't necessarily tracked in impressions and engagements or even ticket sales. It's just the perception that you have, especially in something like recruiting, where perception means so much. And you get the idea, like, once in a while, anecdotally, I guess, a recruit will say, the content was one reason I came here. It's really dope. It really caught my attention. And so it's interesting to see the evolution. I mean, I'm rambling a lot here, but I want to welcome you to sort of offer any comment that you've seen and how you want people to see this more intangible value of having strong creative and what it says about your organization to whoever those people are that you want to be seeing that.
Yeah, we're living in a transformative time, Neil, right? I talk to teams all the time as part of my job, not required, but I love listening into the perspective of college to the pros to agencies. Like, that helps me formulate, you know, what our point of view is when we're building a lot of the tools that we do at Adobe. But, you know, I also try to listen in to understand what are those shifts that people are making. And a lot of the things that I've been listening into recently is content being created outside of just creative departments in athletics, right? And so there are a lot of people that are actually setting up these creative ecosystems, maybe on campus or outside of a campus environment, where they still want to help athletes create content for themselves, right? In the NIL era, it's not just, you can't only depend on the creative team at a university to create them content. It's just not there. And in turn, what I'm hearing from people are athletes are actually gravitated to the fact that when they go to a school, they have opportunities to create content that might not be only dependent on the athletics department. There are other ways of creating content. And I've heard of instances where high-profile recruits are committing to schools because the community gives them an opportunity to create content in a different capacity. Those were things that I dreamed of when I was in college. I used to tell people, like, this is a reason why a recruit's going to commit to a school, because not only do they see the opportunity to play on the field or on the court, but they're going to see their other creative endeavors unlocked because of the people that are on a campus or are in a community. I was told I was crazy years ago, but like, just like everything else that happens in our world, like, that is something that's prominent today. And there are recruits that are making decisions because they see creative opportunities and content opportunities. And so they have to look at it multidimensionally, right? Like, I've been using this word multidimensionally in multiple facets, but this is one of those instances where a recruit, you know, might prioritize being able to play on the field, but they also realize that they have a life outside of just playing that they also need to think about and consider when it comes to being a student athlete.
Something you said there too about like empowering others to create content and that whole aspect. So I want to double click into briefly here, because it's something that it comes up in my own life, even in my own company where we work with a freelance designer. I'm always like, give us templates so that we can easily swap things out. And sometimes the templates don't play that well. And I'm like, maybe he's like, it's conspiracy theory. He doesn't want us to use templates, so that we keep hiring him to create custom things. It's like, should it be the objective of a creative leader to empower, whether it's in the college space, here's a template that any SID with remote knowledge of computers or apps can leverage. Is it also then raising the bar for what a dedicated creative staff should be producing? It's like, hey, well, we don't necessarily need you as much for the day-to-day stuff, because we can do this in Adobe Express or Lightroom or Kafka. We don't necessarily need this stuff anymore. Like, how is that sort of dividing line between what the professional, dedicated creative staff should be producing versus how much they should be putting time into empowering others, creating things that the non-creatives can execute against? Like, how is that changing the role of a creative staff for any organization?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just like you said, right, like templates are this really bigger thing that people are looking at, regardless if that's creative or outside of creative. And from my lens and how I see, many industries transforming, like creative and content is playing a bigger role in how people communicate with each other. And in order to do that, when we build our tools, and I say we, like when I'm as a PM thinking about building tools at an Adobe, we have to make sure that we can support a large amount of people. And that means that we need to build to their expectations, and their expectation is being able to use a tool that they can get their jobs done with. And so that might mean, having a tool that allows you to create a template that you can reuse to get your outputs. And outside of sports, you're starting to see this trend where a lot of companies want their creative teams to be the people that enhance the creative vision and can then output templates for other people to use, right? Yeah. Because at the end of the day, you're only gatekeeping for yourself as a creative team by expecting that you create all the content, right? Yeah. It's not scalable. And the challenge is you're making your jobs harder for yourself. And that's something I preach all the time. Like, are you working efficiently by doing what you're doing, right? Can you provide some of that trust to someone else by setting yourself up for success and them up for success? And so, just like you said, right, there's many tools that are going in that direction right now, where as a creative, you can't just think about being the most creative person, right? And putting all these flashy effects. What do you need in order to communicate the message that you're trying to send out? And maybe that just requires a simple template. And you as a creative setting that up for someone else to go in and just change the parameters that you established. So there's a lot of, like, what I'm seeing is a lot more restrictions. When I say restrictions, it's from a creative standpoint, limiting what someone might mess up, right? Like, I think that was the biggest concern and what led to a lot of people not going in that direction of creating templates. They're like, oh, someone's going to mess this up, so I don't want to set it up that way.
Right.
And as our jobs as PMs, we want to make sure that we build creative confidence by providing you a set of tools that allows you to still be confident when you pass a template to someone else. And so I think that's going to be even more prominent. I think the sports industry is still getting to that stage, right? I think because it's a few steps behind from a creative standpoint, from the general content creative space, I think that's something that people need to learn, which is, how do I establish my role to be helping others rather than just creating stuff? And I think that's what's going to shape the amount we talked about, quantity is a big part of what content looks like today. Like, how many times are you showing up for someone to absorb the things that you're making? And that just might require not prioritizing 1 to 2 hours of manual work for a single graphic. That means 1 to 2 hours making tons of graphics that are going to show up on all these different channels that someone can then get value out of.
Holy. No, it's really well put. I love those. Different directions I want to go here. I'm trying to figure out which avenue I want to go down, Akshay. Let's talk briefly about these real-time events where you just have to create a bunch of content at one time. I mentioned National Signing Day, you talked about a little bit, whether free agency in the NBA or NFL, the content's coming quickly, draft, we did the WNBA draft not that long ago. And so, like, in these moments when you don't know what's, you have this really good content and you just need to swap out maybe a a team logo or a college logo or a player photo or some, like, what does it actually look like from an execution standpoint? And how are the software tools helping to ensure that they can execute in real time? Like, give me the kind of the inside baseball of real time execution from a creative standpoint.
Yeah, real time execution's really interesting. I experienced it in two different capacities at Syracuse and at Bleacher Report.
Yeah.
Right. And I actually feel like it's funny. The team that I worked for at Bleacher Report was like the real time design team, right? Like, that's what we called ourselves. And mainly because we were reacting to news that would happen and we're making social posts. And we were doing it in a very manual capacity when I was there at Bleacher Report. And I think through the time, like, they're a really good example of a team that's really prioritized whether they want to move in a direction where they're doing that same manual task, or if they want to be a little more efficient. Is there a level of automation that plays a role in getting stuff done? Can you establish those parameters early so that when it comes time to react, that you have everything ready to make something happen? And so you bring up good examples when it comes to the NBA draft. One example I think about is like March Madness, for example, right? You have your whole bracket, 64 logos, and essentially at some point you have to make a graphic that shows all the logos and how it all transpires into one winner, but a Final Four and a final championship matchup, right? Imagine how many squares you have to like fill in with those logos. Is that the most efficient way to find the logo, drop it in? How do you set yourself up for success? And I think that's a good example of like trying to think about what automation plays a role. Are there tools out there that facilitate, you know, when we think about logos, that's one part of a larger brand. And so are you building the right brand management solution? Are you using the right brand management solution as well? Like, there's a building aspect and then there's the tools that help facilitate it, right? And so I think there's a lot of different things that you need to consider. And if you want to execute well from a real-time basis, that means being prepared for it and establishing the time that's necessary to get you there. And so I think there's a lot of preparation that goes into some of these things, and especially with the NFL draft coming into play soon. I think what I'm telling teams, because a lot of teams are reaching out to me and they're like, hey, how do I set myself up for success? I'm like, it really depends on, you know, what capacity you're working at. If you're a college team, why don't you set your templates up to be all 32 teams? That might sound crazy, right, to start off with, but think about what you're actually changing. You might be changing a logo. You might be changing a color. You might be changing some text. These are three smaller parameters. If you found the right balance of how those three parameters show up, you can easily automate 32 different versions of it. And when it comes time to actually post one, you post that one, rather than waiting for the draft, waiting for your player to get picked, then creating the graphic and then posting. There's a difference in how preparation can lead you to posting in real time, spending more time packaging your content, right? I think we talk about creating content, but the other part of it is packaging. And I feel like teams don't prioritize packaging enough, because that's what's actually going to help you get the metrics that you're reaching for. And so how do you actually execute and efficiently use the time to get you there? And I think a lot of teams prioritize building in real time rather than preparing and then focusing on the other smaller details that'll actually help you be successful.
Yeah. No, I mean, definitely even from my non-creative eye, something I'll try to notice when I'm seeing those real-time experiences play out is like how much like was already built and they just had to swap out the logo, versus sometimes it's like, Why do they do it this way? It seemed like they could have made their lives easier if they only had like this part of the team logo in it or whatever it might be, or the college logo, whatever you might be thinking about. You're still talking about packaging too, which is really something I want to ask about. When you are executing those real time content or just in general as well, what are you seeing? What are you advising customers as well of Adobe when it comes to creating that maybe that foundational piece of content that's going to live on, that's going to go out on the first tweet or the first Instagram post? But you also need a version that's going to work on Instagram stories. You also need a version that might go on your mobile app. Maybe a version that goes on your website. A version that goes on this platform. Is there like a foundational place that you start with these specs and then work off from there? Or like what are sort of the best practices when it comes to making sure that content can live and thrive in these different places?
I think it's a great question. We're kind of talking about scale here, right? Where, you know, in the past, people were thinking about single deliverables, but single deliverables might be, you know, hundreds of deliverables in today's age, right? Because that same thing needs to show up in different capacities. And because of that, I think we haven't, you know, or when I say that we, I'll put myself in this perspective. I don't really tell people on what the best way of doing that is. I think you have to start with the foundation. What are the platforms you're prioritizing first? So 4x5, for example, is very common across many different social platforms. So I might prioritize that as my first deliverable because I need to have that show up in the best capacity. And then I might prioritize a web banner or a horizontal image. So then I look at that and see how that translates in the same capacity to a horizontal image. And then story. So I think you have to think through what priorities, like what are people going to see first? And does that convey the message that you need? And if it does, then why don't you understand the tools that are going to help you create the other iterations of it? You brought up Adobe Express before. That's a good example of starting with the same with a single template and then being able to resize it to show multiple different pages of content. Then it's going to reshape your template that you originally created from that single page into the other dimensions that you need to deliver for. And that's the, you know, that's where content's going these days, where you shouldn't have to put manual labor into creating the other iterations. That's just a waste of your time, right? Because you've already prioritized your main deliverable. The other ones might not get as much reach or engagement. So why prioritize extra manual labor into making those look perfect, right? It has to stay on brand. Brand is like crucial in all of this. But why do you have to execute more manual labor to get that there, right? That should be on the tools. And those are definitely top of mind things that, you know, when you think about what building products look like, those are things that we're looking at as well.
And I mean, as a quick aside too, does composition come into play there as well? Like, is it better? Should you like make sure that all the content's not like shoved into the right-hand side? Because then when you try to create a vertical version, it's going to be harder to do that. Or is that just more me overthinking it?
No, I don't think you're overthinking it, right? I think every brand has their own brand guidelines and rules that they follow. And in the context of what they do, those are just kind of streams of text that they're including in their brand, you know, the PDF they might give, you know, eventually we'll probably see this in a more technical format where it's already embedded into the things that they're doing. But once you have those rules, the product should be able to do it for you, right? Maybe that doesn't exist today, but I think that's where there's an opportunity when we think about AI, for example, right? How is that helping us facilitate the things that we need? Automation's a good example of one thing you can do today in different capacities to get your job done. But, you know, everyone in sports hates the word AI because they don't understand, you know, what it actually helps you with. But think about what AI is actually supposed to facilitate, right? A lot of what you do is the same pattern, right, that you repeat every single day. And when it comes to creating content, your brand might just be a set of patterns that you follow in order for something to happen. So like you said, right, maybe let's not crowd the top right corner of a graphic. That's a pattern that you've established as a rule. So imagine if that was one rule that you've already established so that when you create all these content, it's following that and it's doing it for you, right? That's the power of AI and how we could understand and do some pattern matching to help you facilitate your jobs much more easily.
Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to think. Let's do it. Because you started talking about AI, and I definitely want to talk about AI a little bit and what your thoughts are, what you're hearing about, of course, what Adobe's doing in the space as well with Firefly and everything beyond.
Yeah.
Yes, I think of it even in my own capacity of I need to almost treat it like I need to keep up with what's going on out there. Like I need to learn how to use AI appropriately. And in the creative space, there might be, as you mentioned, there's a little bit of like, maybe it's unfounded, unease, like, oh, this is eventually going to replace me, or it's going to make me have to like do things differently than I'm accustomed to. So like, is there an education aspect of, here's what AI means for the job of a creative person, here's how to use it, here's how not to use it, here are the ways to best take advantage of it. Like what are you like? Where is AI going? And of course, like what are the best ways to sort of, you know, crawl before you walk and really make the most of it as a, you know, as someone that's in the day to day trenches?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of people look at the generative AI stuff that, you know, you see on social media, and they're like, oh, you just type into this prompt and something happens. And then that's where the fear builds up, where it's, oh, you know, if anyone could type this, they're going to replace my job. If anything, I actually think that's a good call for you to understand if you're putting your resources and your individual time to your content the right way, right? If you're fearful about something, there might be a shift that you can take to make your creations even more creative, right? I mean, I think that's one call to it. I always say this, like, even as someone before I worked at Adobe, like, there were a lot of AI specific tools that were already embedded in the program, right? For example, being able to remove someone from an image, that always existed. There is a tool called Content Aware, right? And all these stuff always existed. And what it's doing is just recognizing what else is in an image. You know, and then there was a neural filters that Photoshop had. They never specifically called it out as AI. I think it's just more of the buzzword that's going on in today's age. And that's what's building a lot of the fear. That and said, I think the same thing I mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, where how do you best utilize AI? Think about the things that are repetitive in your day, right? If you didn't have to do it yourself, is there a pattern that you're following, right? Because essentially, artificial intelligence is recognizing patterns and executing on it so you don't have to repeat the same steps in that same way, right? So when you're typing in a prompt, every keyword that you're adding, it's going through like a filter. I'm obviously oversimplifying here, but like, you know, it's understanding what each of those, what the value of each of those words are in the context of the whole message that you're sending. And so how do you take advantage of that and understand that you can still get creative outputs by thinking about it from a pattern standpoint rather than the technology? I think people get too lost in the technological advancements that AI has done, but they've forgotten on what the true value and meaning of AI is, which is simplifying a long string. I say the long string of text, right? Breaking it down, right? Just like you think of a Grammarly, for example. Hey, is that too long to present to someone? Can you simplify that down to one line? And they're using AI to simplify it down. If you think about it the same way, like, they're looking at patterns. How does that pattern matching translate to creative endeavors? Like, I think we look at it from a content standpoint, but I challenge people that work in like the social space, right? Can you prep a full season's worth of captions, right? We were talking about packaging before and how valuable your tweet is to the content you're posting it with. What if you had a full roster of football players? Could you use ChatGPT, for example, to brainstorm all these cool caption ideas for every player? Build a database of it so that when the time comes, you're prepared to then go and put it out there, right? Or utilize that, you know, for my social media, I've used ChatGPT to analyze, you know, the content that does really well for me and then say, hey, what's the general topic that this is around? Like, what are the words people like?
Yeah.
You might, in the past, might have required a certain tool to help facilitate that. But ChatGPT text prompting can do the same thing for you, right? And it's kind of open for you to explore that through your own means. And so I think there's so much that's involved in this that's outside of just trying to learn AI or learn specific tools. It starts the question, right? Like, what are the things that I'm doing that are repetitive that I can simplify? And it's just getting to this point where it's looking through it from the lens of being efficient.
And I want to like mix a little bit of the art and the science too, or the science and the art, I guess, the reverse order.
Yeah.
And potentially, because when I think about like using a ChatGPT and the level of detail you can put in your prompt to get a better output, it's like, well, you consider the tone, consider like the persona you're trying to reach, like what's their age, and what, like, and I think about that applied to the creative space. Like, I don't know all the things I don't know about Adobe. I think most people probably use Adobe don't even realize. Like, they may only be using whatever 20% of the actual of all the things it can do. And so, like, is there a little bit of, hey, you can learn that when you are eventually creating a prompt, or, you know, utilizing some of the information that the product already knows about the content you've already created? Like, I want to have this level of saturation, or increase this hue by this percent, and do this and do that, and have all these, this sort of atomic breakdown, and like, to use the term atom intentionally, like, atomic breakdown of what creative output is, let alone with generative AI. So you're not just saying, replace this with a wall. Like, to say, what kind of wall? What's the texture of the wall? You know, what color is the wall? Like, how much of that sort of more analytical look at creative is going to enter the picture? Or is there still just, no, the creative needs to play around with all the tools and make this picture of their head come to life without necessarily having to describe every level of detail of it?
Yeah, so there's a couple things you brought up right there that I've always thought about, right? Which is, one, for the longest time, people felt like they were expected to go do all this research on how to use a tool in order to get started, right? Times have changed. That shouldn't be the expectation for anyone, right? I was scrolling through Twitter yesterday, and there was this tweet where someone was like, oh, when did you start your creative journey? And I started in 2012. And it took me a few years to get to the point where I really understood it. And now I'm seeing people that started in 2019, 2020, 2021. Those are just a few years ago, right? And they're executing at the same level. The education's there now, right? So understanding what you need to do to get there is out there. So that's the education part. I think the fact that people say they need to learn tools is a very overrated statement in today's world. That shouldn't be the function of any product. In any world, right? Like, as product companies, you should be able to deliver an experience that's super easy to onboard to and start using, right? That's the expectations. It shouldn't be learn every single thing that's out there in order to be successful. I think you're really hurting your users by doing that. So that's the first part of it. But I think the other thing that you also brought up is, how do you learn about the other aspects of your job and simplify that? So you brought up, you know, like, hey, I already know I'm going to set the parameters to this designer layer in my design to this certain number. And so, like, how does that learn what I'm doing? I think at the same time, we're looking at what creative, I mentioned creative consistency before, and a lot of that aligns with building a brand, utilizing a brand in the content that you're making, right? Because creative tools are meant for many people's jobs today. And so how do we facilitate that from the brand standpoint? How do we make that easier? And so that when someone sees a brand, they can utilize it the right way, absorb the tool, absorb the contents of it, and just start creating. And so I think that's where I see a lot of opportunity in facilitating that to make it easier. And, you know, through time, we're obviously going to see a lot of what you just mentioned. I think one good example of that is looking at what Premiere and some of the video tools that were announced earlier this week about being able to bring in generative AI to simplify some of that, right? I think those are things people never expected, but it's a good example of, you know, using it when you need it the most and it understanding what you probably needed. You probably had to green screen certain aspects, bring it into the composition in order to make it happen. How do you make that easier, right? And let the technology do its thing so that your job is much easier.
Yeah. And I think even just going back to the sort of AI paranoia and fear is that, like, this cycle is not new. Like, when computer graphic design became a thing, like, the artists that were drawing by hand probably felt, paranoid at first as well, that their jobs being taken away. But ultimately, there's something cool about the essence of, I might be sitting at waiting with a Midjourney prompt or a Firefly prompt, and I don't know what the hell to ask it for because I'm not as creative as someone who is truly a creative. And that's going to, you know, maintain across mediums, across platforms, as things evolve. There's still that essence of someone has to be creative and have this picture in their head that they want to bring to life. And that's something that I don't think is going to ever go away.
Yeah.
I want to touch briefly on a number of more things, certainly. But let's touch on a sort of the different aspects that Adobe can let you do. I mean, I think of, you know, in some ways, I guess, like, there, I'm intimidated by, like, I'm not going near, like, After Effects or whatever, Illustrator. There are things that, like, I'm not comfortable really approaching. So, like, when you are first being introduced to someone who's maybe a little more of a noob when it comes to creative, like, is there a right pathway of someone that is good in Photoshop can easily pivot to Illustrator, easily pivot to XD, easily then pivot to, you know, eventually go this direction. What skills are sort of complementary, and how do you guys think about sort of that content mix, as well as what you're seeing play out in the customer space and in the teams, organizations that you guys work with? Like, are video people also going to be the same people that are expected to learn motion graphics? Or like, how are those skill sets mixing? How much separation is there? How much specialization is there? And how much generalization is there?
Yeah, I think I can speak on that from a broader perspective, right? And I think a lot of what you mentioned was, you know, where is the creative industry kind of leaning into, right? In the past, it seemed like you needed to know everything in order to get hired for a job. And what I'm seeing is there's a balance now, right? Just like what we were talking about before, where the specialized people are going to be able to do their specialized things, right? Like I might be a photo manipulator and I can do what I need to get done. And now we're also seeing tools, like we were talking about templating before. If I'm just a general marketer, I should also be able to create content that shouldn't stop me and just be able to utilize the basic tools that I have. I can also create content. And so I think what we're seeing is more people getting access to content, having the tools at their disposal as part of their teams, or if they work at larger companies, they have those subscriptions and they're able to facilitate what they need from the tools that they have, right? And that also gives you room as someone that might specialize as a motion designer, as a designer, or a video producer to do just your job. Because for so long, our time was taken away by doing, you know, the monotonous stuff, right? We don't need to spend 2 hours of our day doing something that someone else could execute. But how do I spend, you know, the 6 hours I already had to do my job and then the 2 hours of extra time I now get to be a little more specialized in what I do, to elevate the amount of elevate the content that I'm already working on, to make it more, premium in a sense, right? When you're creating content, like people always want to put the best quality out. So how does it feel more premium? I think that's what we're seeing now, right? Where it's a little more of a distinguished line of what people can do, how they can do it, and also have the opportunity, if you're already in a specialized role, elevate that.
How is that like the facilitation, or for lack of a term, facility with creating content and scaling affecting like the content output? Like, is there an expectation now that, well, now because of, you know, these AI shortcuts, or the fact that learning your settings in advance and you don't have to spend as much time, like is that just going to increase the volume that's expected? Is that just going to, you know, make us be more cognizant or aware of the quality of the content, so it makes more sense? Like, there's no right or wrong answer for how much content is the right amount of content to put out, or how long should someone spend on a graphic? Like you can spend all day on manipulating a photo, or you can spend, you know, 5 minutes. Like, how do you know when enough is enough, and how are these like new tools that are making it easier to create content affecting, you know, what that calculation, what that math looks like?
Yeah, I think there's a lot that goes into this. I know we both love the numbers and metrics and stuff like that. That plays a role in the decisions that go into creating content, right? Like in the past, people didn't prioritize creating content, and now that's become more of a priority for people. And because of that, the need to create content and how you create content has also changed. And so being able to, you know, have the things that help you dictate that, like you said, you know, enough, like there probably isn't a barrier of like, hey, this is all you can create for us, or we need more than this. I think through time, we're going to see an increasing need of quantity, right? And at the same time, when you can deliver at the quantity, how do you make sure you're not reducing from a quality standpoint? And so I think that's where we're going to see that shift, where as the expectation to deliver more content increases, the tool should be able to help you also produce at a baseline quality, right? Like your bar shouldn't drop because of time. How are tools going to help you keep that bar and only produce higher than that bar? Because we know that like the expectation for content is not going to decrease, right? When we look at it from the analytics and metrics standpoint, you know, a lot of people talk about engagement. I think one thing I look at is reach, and reach can't just be measured by a single tweet or a single campaign, because we've seen instances where people reshare content. How do you actually attribute some of the metrics that go into that when it's not your own? You know, like if, for example, on Twitter, I can post a video that someone else created and add my own, you know, commentary to it, right? That's something I do a lot on Twitter, where I'll take content and say, here's my perspective on it. But the original brand can't really track that unless it's right at a content level.
I can save a graphic and text it to my friend, and you guys won't even know like about that.
Exactly, right? And at that point, you're looking at reach versus single content engagement. And I think a lot of times teams don't think about that perspective. They're like, oh, I need quote tweets, I need retweets and all reposts and all that kind of stuff. And they don't think about how do you make good content that people just want to absorb and send to other people. And I think that's where reach comes into play in a lot of that, and also plays a role in how you're thinking about creating at scale. Because all it takes is one platform to really enhance the success of your campaign that you're working on, the content that you're creating. And so that's what I would say plays a role in a lot of this, is the demand for content is only going to increase. So how do we make sure that the quality doesn't decrease? And when we're met with the expectations of meeting these certain metrics and trying to actually translate that into success, how do we make sure that the tools are also helping you facilitate that?
I mean, what keeps me up at night is thinking like there's a VP of social or a VP of digital or director of social, whatever role you want to call it, and they want to show their bosses that, look, our engagements month over month or year over year went up by a lot, or season over season. And it's like, well, if it's the last day of the quarter and you're like, we are 100,000 engagements short of where we wanted to be, well, it's like, let's go to the creative team. Hey, this guy had like 40 points in two games last week. He's never done that before. Let's create a graphic for that. Let's create a graphic for this. And all of a sudden you're like aiming your way just so you can like beat your numbers. And it's just like this endless rat race of like constantly doing more and more and more, because every post is going to do engagement. And as long as the quality is there, like, I don't really have a good argument against posting more and more, as long as the quality is there. And it's an interesting thing to consider if you're just constantly trying to one up yourself from the last season or last month or last year, let alone the competitive element of having more engagement than the other teams. And
right,
there's no answer here. It's just me kind of venting about this endless piling on of more content, more quantity. It means more engagements. As long as we're measuring total engagements as like a main KPI, it's never going to end, I guess.
Yeah, and you bring up KPI, and it's one of those things where when you think about it from the college sports space, like how many people are actually thinking about KPIs, even from the creative side, like. Sometimes that just doesn't translate. And I think a lot of people, that might seem like a higher up thing. It doesn't seem to roll down at the creative level. And that sets these wrong expectations of like what delivering creative content means.
Yeah, I want to make sure we touch on this. And a couple minutes left here with Akshay Ram. The time is flying by, Akshay. We're going to get to the Turbo Stat in just a moment, I promise. But let's touch on if someone is in that creative seat, that creative director, that someone who's actually creating that content in the Adobe suite or elsewhere, how do you know whether something is good or not, whether something's successful or not? You might have this feeling of like, I'm really proud of this content, and then it comes back and it doesn't have the massive engagement or virality that maybe the social team would have wanted to have. Or maybe you're looking at, did this drive the conversion that we're looking for? Did it drive ticket sales? Did it drive people subscribing or entering a contest, whatever it might be? Like, how, if you are sitting in that creative seat, like, is there a measurable way to know whether something's successful or not? Or is there a little bit of, again, that art, for to use this term again, like art and science there, of knowing that this is quality content, regardless of what the metric says about how it performed?
Yeah, that's awesome. I was just about to say, to rephrase what you said, is how does a creator define success, right? Because at the social level and the marketing level, you have these metrics that kind of translate that. And I think what's missing and what's, a challenge of the college athletic space is they give everyone this title of director. I've ranted about this on Twitter before. They just give anyone this title of creative director, and then they expect them to also create content. So what they're not doing is actually analyzing what's going into producing the content and how that translates, right? And we talked at the beginning of this about how most schools just want to sell tickets to games, right? Or turn viewership up. And don't understand what market size looks like, and if the market size is translating to the expected viewership, all these kind of things. And so creatives don't actually have a KPI that's embedded with what they do, and they also don't get the information from the higher ups. And so how do we solve it is a great question. And frankly, I just feel like creative directors, if you have that title or if you have creative strategy, you need to have a level of understanding of what the quantitative and qualitative, feedback looks like. So if that is, setting KPIs of, you know, in the recruiting space. Like, we're getting this number of recruits by delivering this package of content to the recruit. Obviously, you can't dictate whether the recruit commits or not, right? That's always been the thing. You can't dictate if tickets are going to be sold or not. That's not your job as well. But how close are you meeting the demands of what other departments are asking me, right? And that's where, you know, we talk about creatives, and I've been someone that's been lost in the space where creatives should be, you know, siloed out to do their things to be creative. But many times you need to have that chain of influence where someone can tell you, hey, you know, it's not just about reaching 6 million impressions or engagement, but it's in order for us to get there, we need to deliver in this capacity. And that middle ground between the two, I think, should be facilitated at the creative director role, where they know how to filter the numbers from the creative, allow the creative to do the work, and then they kind of dictate what's our direction to get there, right? And that's where a lot of these titles aren't actually, you know, aligning to fruition with what they say, right? I think they should be that filter between the people that are actually doing the core functions and the people that are asking for it. So that's how you get closer to meeting those demands. I've been in environments where that hasn't been there. And that's where I'd love to see the community move in that direction, where they are understanding the KPIs, they're establishing KPIs, and there is someone that is heading that creative department that's translating that to something that makes sense from a creative standpoint, which is, you know, let's spend this much time to execute on this. If we were given 1 week to get this done, what's the best piece of content we can create? How do we take that, package it in a way where it's not just one deliverable, it's maybe one video, 10 stories that can go across these platforms, right? That's where like the social media team plays a role. I think the creative director has to be that filter that can communicate with the social media manager and marketing to make that happen, right? In college, we see that role just being put on the creative director and they don't know how to move forward from there.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan too of like providing that context, providing that extra information of what we're trying to accomplish here. Not just like making something cool that's going to perform well on Instagram, but here's what we're trying to reach. Here's the emotion we're trying to evoke. Here's what we want to say about our brand. Like if you really know what you're trying to accomplish or something, then you can be, you know, those metrics make a little more sense then. And we know what we're trying to drive from that, who we're looking at. So just the more information you provide, what makes a good creative brief versus a bad creative brief, and having that conversation.
Right. Like, yep.
Well, lastly, Akshay, I promise you this was a terrible stat, but I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about this because I'm interested in the space of just the role you have as a product manager. It's a really, like, people don't know about product managers do. It's a really cool role. You get to really shape where a product goes. You have to really know your users front and back. You have to kind of keep your eye on where the space is going overall, what's capable, what's not capable, what your engineering and product resources are at disposal as well, what's feasible. So like, when you're thinking about taking in feedback from users and the various different types of users, the noob creative like me who isn't that all that well versed versus the, you know, dedicated Adobe person that's been using it for 20 years and knows every ounce and every nook and cranny, they might have different levels of feedback. You might have a giant customer that's paying millions, has tons and tens of thousands of people using Adobe versus a single user that might have different types of feedback. Like, how do you take all this in and understand? And let alone another thing too, that because I work at tech, is sometimes there's what people say they need and what they want versus what they actually need and what they don't know what they want, or what their behavior, actual behavior says versus what they say they need. So like, how do you take this all in? What's your day to day like of trying to translate, where the products need to go?
That's, you know what, I think this is the first time someone's explained my role better than I probably could, to be honest with you. If you go on social media, I think 9 out of 10 people think that my job is to create content. And they fail to realize, like, that's just my hobby, the thing I love doing outside of work. But, you know, you nailed it, right? There is many different expectations of what a product should do, how it should get there. And a lot of the times it comes with different expectations for what it needs, right? Does it need to be more performant? Does it need more features? We talk about more, but maybe it's less sometimes, right? Like, maybe it doesn't need that many features. How do we reduce that? How do we simplify it down so that every feature is used because it has value in the bigger picture of what's going on, right? And so I think that goes into how we think about user feedback. If someone might complain and say, hey, you know, things are not working. My computer's not working. Things are not syncing. You know, a lot of different things, right? And so from our side, we have to think about, are we reaching a baseline of performance that we expect a user to be able to engage with? Are there things that users can do to mitigate some of that, which is restarting their computer, all these kind of stuff, right? Like, these are the common complaints. At the same time, when you look at some of the feature sets that, you know, companies are delivering, it's also with intention, right? They don't want to just put something out for the sake of putting something out. There are consequences of putting out new features, right? Which is understanding what the role of the old feature is when you're moving forward. Do I need this? Can I take this away? How many people are going to be impacted by us removing a feature? And I think that doesn't, you know, the user doesn't understand that. So it's our role to make sure that we're addressing all of these. And that's why I love my job, because it's not just a single dimension. It's multidimensional, where we have to talk to people internally. We have to talk to people outside, not only just solve, you know, I talk about the product I work on in the sports space a lot, but I need to understand the generic ask of that and translate it to maybe healthcare, right? What do people in healthcare need in order to manage their brand? And so I think it's extracting the information that is going to help contribute to the bigger picture, which is more generic. And so that's the way I kind of treat it. But that's my long-winded way of saying, you know, product management is very unique. It's not creating content, but it is looking at it from multiple different lenses and knowing that you can still support a customer, support a business, support an enterprise at their capacities, and understand what that chain of scale looks like, and making sure we're not breaking anything that they care about and they value while also receiving their feedback.
So we could do a whole like 2 hours on just product management and that for the Product Manager podcast, but that's really interesting stuff. And if you have any ideas for features or issues, just tell Akshay, he'll make it happen. I guarantee it. That's just okay. Akshay, really good stuff. We're going to have some fun with you coming up in our version 10 final segment. But first up, still shareable stat coming up right now.
Just awesome stuff. I could really pick his brain all day. We've had tremendous conversations, tons of good insight, tons of good lessons. But stick around for more, because we're going to have some more fun with Akshay in our quick hitting question segment. First episode, shareable stat. And this shareable stat comes from a panel at the recent Gondola Sports Summit. I was lucky enough to attend. Akshay was there as well. He was moderating one of the panels, did a great job. Just a really awesome event put on by Gondola. And one of the stats I want to share, there were many good stats shared, but this one was particularly thought-provoking. And that was from MLB, when they said that the click-through rates on WhatsApp links, when they share a link to their WhatsApp broadcast channel, was 100x. Compared to what they would get when they share a link into Instagram stories. Now, it's not an exact metric. It's not scientific. The guest from MLB was using that as a little bit of hyperbole, I believe, when he said 100x. But just a way to demonstrate and illustrate that the click-through rates for links shared on WhatsApp was surprisingly and tremendously effective, especially compared to something like Instagram stories. Now, why is that? Well, certainly, WhatsApp and Meta behind it, of course, is promoting WhatsApp broadcast channels. It's a relatively new thing, but it's been around for a little bit now. But they're working to make channels more discoverable and more of an asset for teams, organizations to be able to create these broadcast channels. And MLB was one of the early movers in that space. And why would click rates be so much more effective on WhatsApp compared to something like Instagram stories? Well, think about the mechanism of where we are within WhatsApp. It's a messaging platform. You're not necessarily going on there to consume content and swipe through to consume content. You're going on there to communicate and find things that have been shared with you, or to share things with other people. It's kind of like how Instagram has said there's a lot of sharing going on in DMs. This is another avenue for that, where they're sharing, communicating going on in WhatsApp. You might go on WhatsApp to share a link or a meme or something you discover with a group of friends or with your family or with an interest group, or you may go on there and see it because you get notified or see a new message shared to a group that you're in that there's something to check out. And it's really a discovery platform, whereas, you know, maybe when you're just scrolling through the Instagram feed or swipe or tapping through the Instagram stories or wherever it may be, you're more likely just to continue to tap through. You're not looking to leave or looking to find a destination to go to. There's a lot of ways to theorize, a lot of hypotheses. I'm no expert here by any means, but certainly another thing too, of course, is with Meta speaking at the Gondola Summit, they were talking a lot about Instagram broadcast channels. They were also talking about WhatsApp channels as well. And when a platform like Meta comes on site and wants to educate you on opportunities, it's always a good thing to keep an ear open, because that means there's going to be advantages there, especially for early movers, to take advantage of what Meta is trying to get people to do and how the platform and the algorithms and discoverability may affect that. So super interesting, definitely a thought-provoking thing that came out. There was tons of good insight coming from the speakers there throughout the panel, as well as the platforms that were on site with Meta, Snapchat, as well as TikTok, giving the people on site some insight into where their platforms are going and how to use best practices within those platforms. But this one stood out for sure. I wanted to share with you guys today, and that is, according to MLB, again, hyperbole probably inherent there, but just to illustrate the message, according to MLB, click-through rates on links shared in their WhatsApp channel were around 100x compared to what they would get when they share a link in Instagram stories. So super interesting. Think about it, talk about it, take action on it. But more importantly, stick around, because we're going to have some more fun and learn some more from Akshay Ram with our quick-hitting questions.
Back from the episode of Shareable Stat, and I'm joined once again by Akshay Ram. He is a product manager at Adobe. Just dominated, kicked ass interview, learned so much for you. Are you now ready to do a little version 10 final?
Let's do it.
Number one for you. Go back to time Bleacher Report. Tell me the most viral post or content from your time Bleacher Report.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually think it's before I worked there full time. It was during my internship. Mm-hmm. And I was there the summer of, like, I think free agency 2019. So that was when Kawhi went to the Clippers. LeBron went to the Lakers, or maybe it was the season before that. But essentially, there was this 3-day window where I made all these jersey swaps, and each of them got at least close to 2 million likes each. And they all actually happened while I was asleep. So Kawhi signed with the Clippers when I was asleep. And that was actually one of those moments where I had freelanced with them and prepared that jersey swap 6 months in advance. And they ended up posting it, and I woke up to my phone. I actually had to wake up early because I got a call that I had to make other jersey swaps to prep the whole storyline behind it. But that happened. All those happened during my internship when I was sitting in a dorm room in New York City. And needless to say, that was like the first time I was excited to get up early and make some content, because the NBA news world was just blowing up.
That is wild. Are we already at the stage now where you can just, like, it's a jersey swap, just like a 5-second thing where you can just, like, tell the software program, like, Put the jersey on this guy?
I wish. No, I don't. I love the process of creating a jersey swap, so I'll never skip steps when it comes to that.
I love kind of the ones that have fun with it too, and, like, make it intentionally really, really bad, or use like Microsoft Paint to make it really obviously bad. Like, that's always a fun little one. Like, I don't care. We're just gonna make fun. We're gonna have fun with this.
100%. Yeah.
Number two for you. Tell me, going back to time with Syracuse, the most memorable football game and the most memorable men's basketball game from your time at Cuse.
This is a good question. Football, there's so many games. I think my freshman year was when we won 10 games. And so I was new to the fact that, like, I didn't realize that Syracuse had gone through a drought where they didn't really win that many games. And so the 10-win season, I think back on it now, I took advantage of. Didn't really understand what that meant until the following years, where we weren't winning as much either. So the 10-win season holistically was great. The Camping World Bowl was probably my favorite game. Basketball was when, I think this was my sophomore or junior year, when we played Georgetown, and Tyus Battle had a game-winning shot. And there's this echo that happened across the dome. And our video producer at the time, Mike Lang, put together this extended cut where you could feel, like, throughout that video what that felt like in the dome and the whole story behind it. And so I think the content really elevated what actually happened in person. That was a great example of a memorable experience that I can go back and look on because we made this extended cut.
Probably really cool for you to, like, experience the real life thing and see how it played out in content. And
exactly.
Brought to life. And yeah. I can't imagine what it's like to be at I'm going to call it the Carrier Dome. It's always going to be the Carrier Dome to me. I don't know call these days, but it must just be such an incredible atmosphere. So,
oh, yeah.
Number three for you, Akshay. Tell me the pro or college sports team whose creative most impresses you and why. Or if you're worried about, like, hurting feelings because you don't want to play favorites, just someone who's recently caught your eye as having a really good creative.
Yeah, I share about, you know what? I'm not going to do one team. I'm actually going to do a whole state. And Neil, we were talking about it in our intro about where I'm from, but I'm from Massachusetts. I'm from Boston. And you know, for some reason, when I grew up, I never liked the creative teams or the Boston pro sports. I think they were a little behind in some aspects, but what every team is delivering today is just incredible. The Boston Celtics are doing incredible work. The Boston Bruins have a great team that really understand what it means to deliver at the NHL capacity. Boston College is doing great work. And so, you know, and the Boston Red Sox, of course, have had a really great brand. And so all of those teams, you know, I take pride being from Boston now, and I hate talking about those teams all the time, but they've given me reason to talk about them all the time on social. So all those teams, I love the people that work on those teams. I engage with them all the time, and they're producing the content that makes me want to talk about them more.
You know, I love that answer. I will definitely support that. Yeah, the big thoughts caught my eye for a while. Then, and ever since Mark got to the Bruins, just mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, like this whole new level. It's awesome stuff.
Yep.
Number four, you tell me, this is gonna be an interesting one. Tell me the more subtle or lesser known Adobe product feature across any of the products that all users should know about and why.
Yeah. You know what? I'm going to use this opportunity to shout out my own product that I work on. Adobe Creative Cloud Libraries is, you know, we talked about brand management, asset management. That's the tool that got me my job. And I feel really privileged to be able to work on the tool that helped me become better as a creative. So I'm giving my own product a shout out. But at the same time, I do want to say Adobe Bridge is a tool that not enough people use. And when we talk about automation and all the things that can actually facilitate, it's one of my favorite tools. I frankly like it better than Photoshop. And I might sound crazy for it, but you know, when you have a file browser that can actually do the things that you need to and do it at scale or in bulk, you know, it's really hard to not appreciate it. And so I don't think enough people use it. And I've been getting a lot of our own interns from Syracuse on to using it more recently. And they haven't said enough great things about it.
Hell yeah. As someone who works in the greater, touches asset management and as part of our my everyday, it's definitely a very much underutilized thing that more people should take the advantage of for sure. All right, this would be a fun one. Akshay, tell me, number five, the last TV show that you binged and loved, and also the last concert that you went to.
TV show. Some people might call me crazy. I watch All American on CW.
Hell yeah.
And, yeah. And I continue to watch it live. So I didn't necessarily binge it. I would say it's a show I enjoy watching. Concert standpoint is interesting. The last two concerts I had gone to, because I don't go to concerts too much, were actually hosted by Adobe. And so we had 21 Pilots at Adobe Max last year. That was a great one. And then I don't know if we shared this. I think it's out there. For our 50th anniversary or 40th anniversary at Adobe, we had Katy Perry do a private concert for us at the Chase Center here. And I originally thought that day when we had that celebration, I was like, oh, it's probably going to be a local band from Oakland. And we ended up bringing Katy Perry, and she did all, like, literally a whole catalog that was probably longer than a regular concert. And me and my coworkers ended up being front stage for that. Before, like, we didn't even know it was going to be Katy Perry. We just ended up being front stage. And it was, as someone that loves the 2000s era of music, like, and that's the kind of music I grew up on, I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. But it was just an interesting experience. I'm not a big concert guy, though.
I love those answers. I mean, first off, Spencer James all day. Hell yeah. All in. And always a special place in my heart, both because of her College Game Day appearance at Ole Miss. And I saw her on a side stage at Warped Tour before she was big. So I feel like I helped discover her.
There you go.
I definitely appreciate those answers. Yeah. Tell me, you spent time with Bleacher Report both as an intern and also there as well, full time. Tell me the most important lesson or takeaway that from your time at Bleacher Report. There's such a powerhouse in the social media space. Like, what's sort of one big insider lesson that you took away from time there?
Creative can translate to making revenue. And I think the youth in me didn't see that. And I think they're one of the first platforms that really recognized and were able to shape that up. A lot of the things I did in the beginning, like jersey swaps, started as static graphics, and they found opportunities to partner with different companies to elevate that, to actually use that as a way to generate revenue. And, you know, initially when you do, when you don't see the same millions of likes and the numbers translate, you're like, oh, what's going on? But then you realize the content you're making is shaping the way the company can move forward, right? By bringing in that value. And at first I was like, oh, this doesn't make sense. And now I look at it, I'm like, that's so crazy that they were able to elevate that at that moment and do it. And so that was my biggest learning lesson and takeaway. And I got to work with a great group of people I looked up to when I started on social media. And so learning it from their perspective on why we do the things that we do and how it's going to help the business has helped me understand what I do for my job and role now when it comes to prioritizing the things we need.
Man, that is tremendous. 10 out of 10, no notes. I guess say we're for number 7. We talked a lot about this in our interview, but I guess in brief, if you were asked a creative today, how do you evaluate success? How do you think they'd answer?
I think it's tough. It's one of those things that we don't think about all the time. We understand success as delivering something. So if we finish the deliverable, we obtain that as a reason to mean success. I challenge every creative to think beyond that, right? How does that translate? There are things that you can't formidably control, but how does it play a role in the bigger picture? And so we talked about it, like you mentioned in the interview, but like, how do you travel through those channels to see what that actually means in the larger picture? And I think at Syracuse, there's a lot of instances where some of the creative endeavors I was in, we did a docuseries that highlighted the off season of after our 10-win season at Syracuse. And we realized that that helped regain and also increase our season tickets by a significant amount. And so when you travel those channels, you start to understand the bigger picture of things. And so how can you work with the people that you are around to understand what that looks like rather than just caring about what the individual deliverables are?
Yeah. I love that. There's got to be some great gratifying things too, to when you like see a reply or a comment that's like, this is sick, or this is dope, or this content's awesome. Like,
yeah.
Keep you going on those late nights when you're burned out or something as well.
100%.
All right, time for our food question, Akshay. I love our food questions. We always got to ask our food question. We're going to have a little bonus food question here as well. So first, if I come up there to the Bay Area, San Francisco, and we go get a meal, what's the best meal to get? Where are we going? And then bonus question, is Dino Barbecue out in Syracuse, overrated, properly rated, underrated?
Gosh. I'm still in the process of learning. You know, I'm challenging myself to go find new food spots every weekend in San Francisco because it's just known as a place for having so much variety. I'd say best restaurant to go to, in my opinion, that I've experienced so far is a place called Foreign Cinema. And it's just, they play all these old movies and their menu, if I'm not wrong, they change it every single day. And wow. It's very like uplifted, high lifestyle kind of place. You probably go once a year, if anything. So that I really enjoyed it. I went recently with some college friends and it was so much fun. If you're just trying to grab a bite, you go to the Mission District and you go to La Taqueria. That's the like known burrito place that everyone goes to. I'll probably go there once every other week. And I'd say like that's true, authentic Mexican burritos. It's great food. I will try to raise the hype on it, but it's really good food.
Oh yeah. And how about Dino Barbecue? Is it all hyped up to be?
I'm gonna struggle with this one. So I went to Dinosaur Barbecue a couple times when I was at Syracuse, and every time I went the food was good. I don't think it's overrated. I think it gets a good level of hype that I think it's properly rated for what people say. Like, you're not going to go there and feel disappointed. And so I'll say it's properly rated. I might get some, you know, people might disagree with me and think it's still underrated. And so I think it's a place you go to.
is there another food place or restaurant that, like, if someone's going to go visit Syracuse, that, like, they should go there instead and not go to, like, the touristy place?
Yeah, there is. Gosh, I'm forgetting names at the moment. There are a couple different places. I know one place that, you know, people will disagree with me on this, but this, I have a different reason on why I like this place. There's a pizza place near campus called OIP. And on Fridays, as a creative group, me and Noah Hammerman that works for the 49ers, we made it a tradition now on Fridays to take our whole creative team and get pizza. So that we called it Pizza Fridays. And it started our freshman year. We carried it over, and it was, I think, memorable because the pizza's good, what you would expect on a pizza. But I think it was the moment where we were able to all come together and have a conversation while eating lunch that we couldn't do on other days as students. It was a tradition we started for students, and I think it carried around for a little bit. But that's where I would go if I had to go back to Syracuse right now, is go get a meal there. But I'm sure there's much better places, and people are going to call me out for not mentioning those.
No, that gets me all the right feels. And I'm glad my barbecue is good, but maybe not legendary.
Yeah.
All right, coming down to the wire here, Akshay. Tell me, number nine, you got 5-10 minutes to kill. You're in line at Starbucks or a taqueria. Which app are you opening to pass time? Whether you want to name more than one or just one, which app is your go-to to fill 5-10 minutes?
Yeah, Twitter. Yeah, it's an easy one for me. I'll scroll a little bit, make sure I don't get too lost into it. Find the content I need, save a couple bookmarks if I need to, and then get back to it when I get back. But I think it's Twitter for now.
For you feed or following feed?
Oh man, that's a good question. The algorithm has changed a lot, you know, since Elon took over. I think for some time I had to go following. I think I'm back on For You because the opportunity to learn more about creatives that I don't know about is fun. And so I'm trusting For You for now. I'm sure Elon's going to change something tomorrow and I have to go back to following, but I'm on For You for now.
I like it. And I'm also very glad that you are Team Twitter, not calling it X, because I refuse to call it X.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right, last word for you. Tell me, this is going to be a good way to get to know you a little bit about your favorite teams. The sports team whose championship-winning graphic you most want to see.
I'm definitely going to say the Celtics. I'm a diehard Celtics fan. And, you know, we have an upcoming playoff run, and I'm expecting a championship graphic from them. I'm more excited about the championship video that they're going to put together. I'll put the graphic aside. I'm excited to see the recap. What's the thing that they do during March Madness at the end?
One tiny moment.
Yes, I want that for the Celtics when they end up winning the championship this season. So we'll see how it goes. I don't want to jinx myself, but that's the one I'm excited about.
There we go. I mean, they're certainly, I would think, the odds-on favorite to win the East. So,
right. Yeah.
Good luck. Good luck to the Celtics. All right, Akshay, you kicked ass. Your version 10 final was accepted. Now your chance to take over the podcast and tell us your social media all-star poll. Just tell us who they are, what platforms they're on, and why they're following.
Yeah. You know, I got to give a shout-out to my friend Connor Henkel here. He's been rising over the last year, posting content in a space that I think was really undervalued before. So he posts a lot of motion graphic stuff. You know, the things that he does to get things on billboards, or sorry, like in-game experience stuff. So what does emotion go into a lot of that? Yeah. And so, you know, he's a great follow, and him and I are very similar in the sense where we like to micro, we like to understand design and creative at the micro level. And so if you like my stuff, you're going to love his stuff. He's a great person. And so I love every time he posts. And so I'm going to give him the social media all-star.
Hell yeah. And we'll shout out his handle, link him up on the show notes and the transcript. So look out for that. And yeah, it's a great point. Just by the way, on the level of talent that goes into the video board and motion graphics, like sometimes you think about creative just being all about like social media feeds, but you look at the video boards, you look at, the bumper videos on ESPN before like going to commercial. Like there's so many things that creatives are executing that you don't think about. You don't just like in your feed necessarily. It's just so much talent. It's so much cool stuff happening every day.
You know.
And actually, how about you? Where can we find you as well as all the things? I mean, I'm not going to make you shout out every single Adobe handle, but where do you want to send folks to follow you in Adobe?
Yeah, I think you can go and follow me. I'm by Akshay Rob on almost all platforms. So feel free to follow me, and you will find an Adobe social if you're just on social media. So I won't worry about shouting them out. I think I'm super grateful to work there, but you'll find it if you're on social media.
If you are listening to this podcast, you're probably already an Adobe user, so you know plenty of places where you can go find it. Information and play around with their platforms. But Akshay, Kanal, thank you for coming to the podcast today, sharing us your wisdom and knowledge, and really appreciate all your time.
Neil, I appreciate you so much. I truly enjoyed this conversation, so thank you.
Man, thanks so much again to Akshay Rom, product manager at Adobe. Cannot thank him enough for coming on the podcast today. Just so much good insight. He is a relatively pretty young man, still just getting started in his career, and we are lucky to have him in this industry, really being a voice for us within the Adobe platform, which of course a lot of organizations use to create their content. He has such good insight into what content is working, how people are creating content, how to think about evaluating content. Just shared so much good information today. Cannot thank Akshay enough for lending some of his time and his wisdom today for the podcast. But that'll do for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. As always, you can find me on Twitter at NJH287, also on LinkedIn where I post more content. I would love for you to check out the website, dsmsports.net, where there's more episodes and content. And of course, I would also love for you to check out the website Slike, where you can find collections of great content and create collections yourself to crowdsource curation of anything you're looking for. So Slike, slyke.co. And of course, check out the podcast on your preferred podcast platform, because we'll have more episodes coming at you soon. Until next time, this is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.